But even there's a limit to what spread boards can support. And we'll talk about that in just a little bit. But this is, these are slides from Dr. Mike Brown's data at the USDA station El Reno. And if you've never visited there, you need to do that. It's an old remount station. The cemetery is really cool. But beyond that, they've done some really good work there, and I think maybe it's been overlooked. And it's not just because my name's on a couple of papers. But what Dr. Brown did is he exposed a group of cows sired by Brangus bulls with a wide range of milk EPD to their beautiful, and I mean beautiful, tall grass native prairie pastures there. They have pretty deep soil for Oklahoma. We call it dirt here. But we do have a little bit, and there's quite a bit of it there around El Reno. And so it's about as good a native grass system or production, forage production, we can come up with in Oklahoma. What he discovered was, what you see here, is that there's a limit to what, in terms of genetic potential, to what that forage in El Reno, Oklahoma can support. Okay? And so you see both 24-hour milk yield in the graph on the left, and calf weaning weight in the graph on the right. Higher milk cows wean heavier calves. Yes, they did. But once you get on the graph on the right, once you get about a milk EPD of around, 4 to 5, I can't see it very well from here, what you've got, and maybe it's expressed a little bit better in this graph, and this shows his milk yield by month. Okay, and so in April, the solid line on the top, the line's a little steeper, but it levels off eventually, right? So even in April, peak milk yield in these cows is limited by the forage resource. Look how flat the line is in August and September when they're at the bottom end or the tail end of that lactation curve and when forage quality is declining. Okay, so what you have here from somewhere around, 4, 5, 6 milk EPD in these Brangus cows, from there to the right, what you have is a set of cows that has higher overhead to keep the factory open. Okay, and no more production. Does that make sense? The forage has limited their ability. The environment has limited their production capability. And so I'm going to suggest to you that, number one, there's increasing risk and frequency of cases where forage resources limit the expression of genetic potential for milk in our business now. I think the pendulum has already maybe swung too far. Production costs have increased because the environment has been artificially modified to fit the cows. Okay, I think maybe what we're doing in a lot of cases, not just with this issue, but to maybe growth as well, is we are modifying the environment to fit the type of cows that we like instead of working hard to make sure that we have cattle that fit our forage resources. Okay, so I'm going to stick my neck out and say that here in a room full of sharp axes. Okay, so what about cow size, muscle, and growth? Now, we only addressed growth in the proceedings paper. But I don't really know how to talk about any one of these issues without talking about the others, because they are so related. And you can draw lots of different lines between all of these topics and have a very good discussion. And just like Dave Daly said yesterday, probably if you wanted to support a position, you can find the literature to do that. Relative to, whether we need more growth, more mature cow size, and more muscle or not. So it's not terribly straightforward, other than I would say for cow size. I think the literature is a little bit clearer on that topic than it is for growth and muscle. So this is what's going on. This is the 2013 crossbreed adjusted trends for a few breeds in terms of yield yearling weight. Okay, so the topic here is matching cows to forage resources. What does that do to a commercial cow in a limited environment? Well, the truth is, I honestly don't have a real good answer for you. I thought it was very appropriate and visionary of Dr. Cora to organize a conference, a little conference there at NCBA this year with several experts from around the industry. I just kind of snuck in the back and listened from the back of the room. And they had a good discussion about these topics. But I think we need to be doing more of that. Because isn't it obvious? We are in a never-ending arms race for growth. Everybody is. Does that have implications to cows? Probably. Probably. And I think we need to be talking about it and thinking about it more instead of just blindly chasing growth. Okay, and obviously there are benefits to growth. I mean, we wouldn't be doing it if there weren't. So let's take a look at some of the things that are changing. Well, okay, what about, this is Angus data because they're good enough to provide it on their website. It's really interesting to see what's happened. This is the weight per inch of height, yearling Angus heifers over time from 1982. The latest information I had was 2011. Okay, so that has increased, weight per inch of height. And so what that, to put that in perspective, in 1982, a 48-inch heifer weighed about 720 pounds. And what about 2011? That same 48-inch heifer, a year of age, weighed 841 pounds. So are cattle changing? You bet they're changing. Not in frame size, but in weight. Now, this is the first data there is from the era I told you about, the era coming out of the era of insanity in terms of selecting for more air under them, right? And so, you know, that's going to happen if things are getting better. And I'm not saying that this is all bad. It's probably a lot of really good things that have occurred here. But what has changed? If there's another 120 pounds in those yearling heifers at the same height, what has changed? Well, they probably do have more muscle and more capacity, right? That would be my guess. This is a genetic trend for ribeye area and would suggest that we are selecting for more muscle in the cattle industry. And if you take those top two breeds out and look at the continental breed or the English breeds there, those lines look a lot steeper. It looks like they are really rapidly or aggressively selecting for muscle. So what does that have to do with the cow? Because my job is not to talk about carcass characteristics, it's to talk about cows. Okay, so what implication does that have? And I think it has substantial implications. It's not as clear. My question here is how will continued aggressive selection for muscle impact those commercial cows' matching ability? And let me just tell you that the answer is not clear. I think that maybe this one is the least clear of all three of those topics. However, according to a lot of Dr. Farrell's work, and I'll just admit I've talked to him on the phone several times the last few weeks trying to ferret out these differences because I have a lot of respect for Dr. Farrell and Jenkins. They are the pioneers in this area. And he's the one that suggested that I look into some of these issues. And according to their data, there is a minor increase in maintenance requirements when you add muscle. It's not dramatic. Okay? Much more important, perhaps, is increased mature weight. When you select for more muscle, and I'm going to show you how that can happen, really what you're also doing is selecting for more mature weight. Interesting idea, and some of you geneticists have known it for a long time, but it's true. And Dr. McNeil's data showed several years ago that there is a positive genetic relationship there. More muscle equals less fat, same live weight. Okay, I'm going to show you a graph here in just a second to kind of describe how that works and what I mean and what implications that has on cows today. Okay, undesirable associations between maternal traits and retail product appear to be mediated through fat thickness. And Dr. Tess is sitting right back here. And he's the one who wrote this article and a couple of things since that time that suggest that, you know, and we've known for quite a while that fat has a lot to do with mediating the neuroendocrine system that triggers a cow to begin cyclicity, fertility in general, heifer puberty, and so on. Fat is important. And so increased You don't get increased muscularity without impacting animals' body composition relative to fat. So it has implications from that standpoint. One paper very clearly said, and there are several that wouldn't be as maybe as strong as this one, but one said that lower adipose composition is associated with overage puberty, lower conception rate, and lower calving rate. Now, these relationships weren't terribly strong in this paper, but they were in that direction. Okay, so it's going to be hard to do without my pointer here, but let me talk about muscle and body composition relative to mature weight here for a few minutes. So what you've got here is the 1996 National Research Council's equations for body composition in calves. The red line represents protein. The bottom of the graph here, I don't have units, but you can just imagine either live weight or body condition scores. And body condition, actually the equations are related to body condition score. They go from 1 to 9 across that graph to the bottom. Okay, the yellow line represents fat composition as a percent of the animal's empty body weight. Okay, so what you see is that as fat composition increases as a percent of their empty body weight, muscle tissue declines. So that's just if you take an individual cow and you change her composition through feed or energy and protein availability. Okay, that's not genetic selection. That's just changing one cow's body composition through her nutrient availability. All right, so if, Dr. Selk has taught for years and many other extension people that if you want to maximize reproductive efficiency, mature cows need to have a body condition score of somewhere around 5, okay, give or take. But if you always feed your cows to a 3, you're going to have a harder time getting a lot of them bred. You probably don't need to feed them to a 6 or a 7 all the time. You'll spend a lot of money to maximize reproductive efficiency. That occurs somewhere around 18% body fat in a cow, according to the National Research Council. Okay, somewhere around 18%. So what if we select for increased muscle, and we bump the red line up, and I've just bumped it up 4% here. What happens? Well, you don't get, Dr. Farrell said, he told me on the phone, he said, you don't get to change muscle without changing fat. Right? They are highly related, and so what's going to happen is the yellow line has to go down if you replace it with more muscle tissue. And so effectively, what you've done, if you're aiming for the same body composition to retain fertility, the same level of reproductive efficiency, you move that magical line to the right. They either have to weigh more or have what we consider maybe a higher body condition in order to accomplish that. And now that's if you just have to have the same percent of empty live weight of body fat. If, I can't point it out to you here, but if you have to have the same relative, they almost, those lines almost cross in the first one, they're at 18%, the protein and fat line cross. So look where they cross once we've selected. It's even further to the right. Okay, so if the magical thing is equal percent body fat and muscle tissue, then we push that line even further to the right. So that's why live weight has to increase in order to accomplish that. And if we continue selecting for muscle, that's what we're doing, is selecting for larger cattle. Excuse me. So is that going on? Well, according to the mature weight EPD in Angus cows, it looks like it is. Now, we've shrunk that axis, that y-axis there, and so it looks pretty dramatic, but actually when you look at it, there's only, 16 EPD units difference there over a 21-year period. And so, yes, it's going up. It's not going up extremely rapidly, only less than an EPD equivalent a year, and so it's not terribly dramatic, but it is increasing. So I have to ask ourselves, what does that do in terms of cows in commercial operation with low inputs? The genetic trend from mature hides has been flat since 1987. So the cow's composition is changing, not necessarily their mature hides. Okay, so let's switch gears then and talk just a little bit about bigger cows. Do they wean bigger calves in a restricted environment? There's a lot of publications on this. Dr. Kraut wanted me to really spend some time on this, so I'm going to spend just a little bit of time on this question. I'm going to do it very simply. This is work of Chelsea Dobbs, Gant Bauer, and an older publication from 1971 in Montana. What you see here is a commercial cow herd, lots of weaned calves mashed up with their mature cow weight there at the time of wean. When you first look at that graph, this is just from about 2011. We put this together. But when you look at that graph, first thing I think is important to notice, it looks like somebody nailed it with a 12 gauge, right? Meaning, there's not really a very strong relationship there at all. There is a positive trend or regression line through that. Now, what the regression line here, this is Chelsea's data, says is that it's in the top right equation there. And I'm going to put it in 100 units of cow weight. For every 100 pounds you add in cow weight, you get 6 pounds of additional calf weaning weight. Okay, the Montana group said that number was 4 pounds back in 1971. Gant Mauer's data on another ranch in Oklahoma said the number was 6.4 pounds of additional calf weaning weight for 100 pounds of additional cow weight. And another data set of Chelsea's from University of Arkansas on fescue pasture said that the number was 6 pounds. Again, so really fairly consistent. Brian Frecking has some data from Southeast Oklahoma that suggests a different environment. Down there on commercial cows, they might get 17 to 20 pounds of additional calf weaning weight for 100 pounds of cow weight. Okay, so what are the implications then? Dr. Doy has a nice paper out that shows you here the value of added gain. If we assume 80 cents, $1, $1.20 value of added weight gain, you know, still it's worth $5 to $7 basically. What is the key to cost to keep that extra 100 pounds of cow weight around? That's the question we have to ask. Dr. Doy says it's $42. For 100 pounds of additional cow weight, it's about $42. We're getting the value of additional calf weight. Once you get beyond about 1,100 pound cows, you're getting another 6, 5 to 7, right? It costs about $42 according to Dr. Doy's economic analysis. So I don't get it. Now, maybe some of you can look at data like this in your environment and figure out that maybe you can wean 50 pounds of additional calf weight for additional 100 pounds of cow weight. If you can do it, congratulations, but I haven't seen any data yet that suggests anybody can do that. You might be able to accomplish it with creek feed or grazing on wheat pasture with cow-calf pair all winter long. Maybe. But it's going to take almost 50 pounds per additional 100 pounds of cow weight to pay for it. Okay? And we're a long ways from that. All right, growth and feed intake. Real quickly. I'm going to run out of time here. But again, this is the growth. We're in a kind of a never-ending arms race. Well, what does that have to do with feed intake? Forage intake of your cow. And so if we continue to aggressively select for growth and the nutritious views, so really what's going on is your train or your breeding cattle that eat more feed. NEM is lower, is one reason why that would continue to increase. Or the efficiency of feed use for growth, that energy gain, I'm just going to say, keep it simple, is better. Okay, some of those things have to be happening. I don't think the one in the middle is going on. NEM is lower. I don't think we're reducing NEM by selecting for more growth. And I'll show you why. I don't think that's possible. Well, maybe it's possible, but I don't think it's going on. There's a positive genetic correlation between growth and feed intake without question, according to this publication and several others. So increased feed intake and gut capacity results in increased visceral organ mass, that is, heart, kidney, liver, small, large intestine, and brain. They get bigger. And yes, just like milk, The GI and liver make up less than 10% of the cow's body mass, but they account for 40 to 50% of their total energy intake. Okay, so that's according to some of Dr. Farrell's data. So I'm just going to ask, is it possible that continued selection for growth and capacity in cattle is a contributing factor to high cost of maintaining these cows? Okay, I'm going to stick my neck out in this, like I said, room full of sharp axes and ask that question, because I think we need to be thinking about it. All right, so I'm going to quote Legion here. I read a paper here just recently. I think it's really spot on and related to this. It fits my bias, so I put it up here. Belly draggers are not always more efficient cows. Most of the time, our deeper rib cow consume more than average on a daily basis, and they don't gain enough to pay for the extra consumption. Okay? All right, so let's switch gears in. I'm probably about out of time, so let's just talk about some other implications I've been talking to our extension educators about, and then maybe some things we need to consider in terms of priorities going forward. What we have been doing, I think, I'm going to pick on my academic contemporaries and group for a few minutes. It's interesting to think about this, but what we've been doing is teaching guidelines, like, let's say, for example, the body, always have your cows at body condition score 5 to get in breeding season. They daily mentioned that yesterday and said, you know, sometimes that's just not very practical. And if you have to do that, if you're forced to do that, it can be really, really expensive. Okay, and so what we've been doing is teaching guidelines based on conditions that reflect a nutrient status that maximizes reproductive performance. I think that's what we've been doing for quite some time in extension and academia. A major limitation to that approach is focused on short-term effects with little consideration of long-term implications, i.e. all the suggested focus yesterday on fertility gets lost when we do this, because what we're really doing is artificially modifying the environment. Okay, and Dr. Andy Roberts said it really well, and this has been quoted several times, and it's very appropriate. He says, feeding to maximize reproductive rate does not result in differential retention between females with high and low feed requirements. In contrast, managing cows under reduced feed inputs are more likely to result in culling of cows with high feed requirement due to reproductive failure. Reproductive failure can be a good thing sometimes. I heard a purebred guy say one time, he said, I'm not too sure an 8% pregnancy rate is not a good thing for my commercial producers. And I think maybe that's maybe a little aggressive for most of us, but actually the concept, I think, is really valid. Furthermore, increasing the proportion of cows with reduced feed requirements may provide producers margin of safety at times when feed resources are scarce or costly. I don't know about yours, but our climatologists continue to predict long-term drought in our region, and so that's a particular concern right now. Okay, improving match, just a few things, and most of this will be old news to many of you, but some new thoughts or concepts, and maybe some aggravating ones for some of you seedstock folks, but most definitely it requires a long-term commitment. I think it only makes sense if you're a commercial operation to select for moderate size, moderate milk, and moderate muscle in the cow herd. Okay, cull open cows, and that means be willing to challenge those cows to your environment. Make them show you who fits. Resist the temptation to gradually modify the environment. And I think for a lot of commercial folks, the amount of feed has gradually increased, maybe slow enough that they don't notice it. Maybe the length of the hay feeding season has gradually extended. Maybe your stocking rate has gradually come down so that the cow can select a higher quality diet. There's lots of ways to artificially modify the environment. Okay, keep on the early born heifers, keep on the early bred heifers, and buy or keep bulls out of cows that always calve early. How many of us do that much homework when we go buy bulls? Yeah, I think that's important. A lot of new tools available, and they're going to help. I think the thing we have to do is make those tools and others the priority and not just an afterthought. Improving reproductive efficiency, and again, this may be hard on some of you seed stock folks, but I tell our producers that I think it's important that you need to find a source of seed stock that puts a priority on economics relevant traits related to fertility and forage use efficiency. Not just an afterthought. And oh, by the way, they're decent in that, so we'll go ahead and pick that ball up. But put some priority on it. Foals, open cows, keep on there. All the same things I suggested for the commercial folks. It's good for the purebred breeders, too, from the seed stock producers. Purchase bulls out of cows that are managed like yours are, or worse. Pretty hard to buy a scrawny-looking bull out of a thin cow, huh? Yeah, so what we have here is a little bit of a social problem relative to marketing, right? And I'm not near smart enough to address that. But when you have difficulty selling cattle to commercial breeders because they don't look good enough, what it does is kind of perpetuates these problems. And so I really like Dr. Borden's quote here. It's been used many times. I think it's very appropriate. It says, "To breed for optimum means to have a target in sight beyond which you don't want to go. Don't let the pendulum swing too far. Don't just follow the trend." Okay? If your goal is to maintain an optimum level for any trait, the evidence of your accomplishment is not visible change, but the lack of it. And a very wise statement, I think, relative to producing cows that match forage resources. Okay, so in summary, I think there's no strong evidence that commercial cow efficiency has improved, at least in a sell-up weaning context. From a commercial cow-calf perspective, the industry is on an unsustainable path relative to some traits. Okay? Get your sharp axes out. Cows are big, and we can't get enough milk or muscle. You heard yesterday that the average cow weight of most of the breeds is right around 1,400 pounds. The result, I think feed inputs or costs per cow-calf unit are increasing while limited data suggests that production may not be. And relative new tools are available that will help. However, those must become a priority in selection decisions and not considered secondary traits. All right, I'm going to quit. I don't know, Dr. Stein, if you want to take any questions, but one or two questions, he says.